Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway and we're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 9th of January. Our main stories: Ukraine says it's investigating four possible causes of the plane crash in Iran, including terrorism and a missile strike. Iran says it was a technical fault. Afghan officials say a senior commander of a Taliban splinter group was among 16 militants killed in an American drone attack. And a campaign to end rape in war, spearheaded by Angelina Jolie and a British politician, is heavily criticised. Also in the podcast, Prince Harry and his wife Meghan say they want to step back from royal duties and become financially independent. But how will that work?
There is a danger that they back down and they cash in on their royal status. And that won't go down very well. It looks as though they're, you know, having their cake and eating it.
Speculation that a Ukrainian airliner which crashed near Tehran on Wednesday had been hit by a missile has been rejected by Iran. The Iranians had launched attacks on US targets in Iraq only hours earlier, but most experts said there was no evidence the aircraft had been struck. Now the head of Ukraine's Security Council has said investigators at the crash site should look for possible debris from a Russian missile. Russia has been accused of involvement in the downing of an airliner over Ukraine in 2014. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, appealed for an end to speculation, but said his government was determined to find out what happened.
The priority for Ukraine is to identify the causes of the plane crash. We will surely find out the truth. For this purpose, a thorough and independent investigation will be conducted in accordance with international law by the Islamic Republic of Iran.
All 176 people died when the three-year-old Boeing 737 came down shortly after takeoff. I got the latest on the investigation from the BBC's Jonah Fisher in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev.
Look, earlier today, I think we were in a position where opinion amongst those who were following this very closely seemed to be coming to some sort of consensus that technical failure was almost certainly the cause of this plane crash, particularly in the light of what the Iranians have been saying from their preliminary investigation. That has rather been blown out of the water by a security official here in Kiev, a man called Alexei Danilov. He's a very senior member of the government here. He has representatives on the ground in Tehran as part of Ukraine's investigation team, and he basically laid out four options which these Ukrainian investigators want to explore in Tehran. Firstly, and it's a particularly explosive option, they want to look at the idea that the plane was shot down, possibly by a Russian anti-aircraft missile that was fired at it. Secondly, they want to look at the possibility that there was some sort of drone or collision with the plane. Thirdly, whether there was a terrorist attack on board which led to an explosion. And fourthly, that technical failure option, which is the one which the Iranians are, of course, pushing. So I think there's a sign that the Ukrainians, or certainly elements within the Ukrainian government, are not accepting the Iranian explanation for what has happened. And they really want those investigators that they now have on the ground to get proper access to the crash site and really have a look around.
There are a lot of Ukrainian investigators now heading to Iran to look at this. When will we find out, or when will we get closer to exactly what happened, given that the Iranians do have the black box?
This team of 45 Ukrainian experts and officials is already on the ground. They flew in overnight. So they will today be trying to get access to things related to the crash, possibly the crash site itself. The question of the black box, this flight recorder, well, that is a key issue. We've had an Iranian official from the aviation authority this morning come out and confirm that they do have these flight recorders and that the memory cards inside, They are intact, but they are damaged. Now, that raises the possibility, perhaps, that all that information about the last moments of the flight might not have survived the crash. Now, if that is the case, people will, of course, continue to speculate about what has happened. There is the question looming also about what happens to those black boxes. In a normal investigation of this sort, the black boxes would be returned to Boeing, the manufacturers of this aircraft, for them to do that in-depth analysis. There has been some indication from the Iranians that they don't want to do this. They don't want to send it to Boeing. They don't want to send it to the United States. It will be very interesting to see whether they will let someone else, perhaps the Ukrainians, take the black boxes away for analysis.
Jonah Fisher in Kiev. Most of the passengers on board were travelling to Canada. 138 of them, including 63 Canadians, were due to take a connecting flight from Kiev to Toronto. The city is home to one of the largest Iranian expatriate communities in the world. From Toronto, this report by Neda Taufik.
Returning to campus at the University of Toronto after the holiday break should have been a joyous occasion. Instead, the Iranian-American community here is overwhelmed by grief. Dozens have gathered to mourn eight of their friends who were taken too soon.
I think everyone's just heartbroken. Everyone's just trying to process it and believe it.
Once you walk into the room, there are pictures of the victims along with flowers and candles. It is clear that this is a tight-knit community. Everyone here knows at least one, if not more, of the victims. And there's hardly any room to stand as people come to pay their respects and to pray for them. For Canada, this is one of the deadliest air accidents in recent times. 63 Canadian nationals were among the victims, along with several international students attending universities across the country. Members of the same family were lost, such as Mohammed Hossein Asadilari and his sister Zainab, still in her 20s.
She was such a traveler. She loves exploring the world.
And husband and wife Mohammed Salehay and Zahra Hassani, who came to Canada from Iran 18 months ago.
She was an extraordinary human being, very kind, very patient.
And Mohammed Mahdi Elyasi, a mechanical engineer that helped teach English to refugees.
He was a brilliant guy. He was a genius.
The shock of the tragedy is visible on each and every face here, including student Nikta Tarabian, who couldn't wait to see her friend Zainab.
It's just I don't know how to react. Like this person we were literally texting 2 days ago, she was online on social media, and then within a few minutes she's gone. Like, I don't understand. Like, she was coming back.
Yeah, I think it's everybody's worst nightmare coming true.
Sayed Hussein Mortazabi, who lost his childhood friend, says it's a difficult time for a community already concerned about tensions between the U.S. and Iran.
You imagine, you think about what could happen if a war breaks out. And for us, we just experience the loss itself. It just makes you numb.
There are many questions those here want answered about the crash. For now, though, they are focused on saying goodbye to their loved ones.
Neda Taufik reporting from Toronto. At least 16 militants, including a senior commander of a Taliban splinter group, are reported to have been killed in an American drone attack. Afghan officials said Mullah Nangyalai, a top commander of the Taliban faction, was among the dead. Our South Asia editor Anvarasan Etirajan gave me more details about him and his group.
This was formed in 2015 when the news about the original founder, Mullah Omar, died in a few years ago at that point of time. And then there was some leadership tussle within the Taliban movement. When Mullah Mansur was appointed, then another mullah, another commander, Mr. Rasool, he did not accept that. So he formed his own group. And there have been intense clashes between these two groups, that is the Taliban and the breakaway faction, for the past few years. And some reports suggest that, you know, in the western part of Afghanistan, which is bordering Iran, that is also a very well-known drug trafficking route when both factions try to control the drug trade. So now the Afghan officials are saying that This one of the senior commanders of the breakaway faction and other militants have been killed in an American drone strike, because it is very common in Afghanistan for some of the militant leaders to live in residential areas. And there are conflicting reports about civilian casualties.
Presumably this faction not engaged in those peace talks with the US. You said the provinces bordering Iran, of course, we're seeing these tensions between the US and Iran, and some suggestions they could derail those talks.
Afghanistan is really, really worried about what's happening between Iran and the United States, because, you know, you have a number of U.S. bases in Afghanistan, and there were reports suggesting that the Pentagon was also discussing about using some of these assets in case of any conflict with Iran. That is really worried the Afghan government and also among the local officials there, because Iran has a huge cultural and political links with the Afghan leaders. And also there are some suggestions that some low-level Talibans also had contacts with the Iranian leadership. So it is very complicated, and Afghanistan doesn't want any escalation.
Our South Asia editor, Anbarsan Etirajan. The newspapers are calling it Mexit, the decision by Prince Harry and his wife Meghan to quit as senior members of the UK royal family. Queen Elizabeth is reported to be deeply upset at the announcement, with Prince Charles incandescent with rage. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex say they will work to become financially independent while still supporting the Queen. But is that possible? A question my colleague Dan Damon put to David McClure, who's written a book about royal finances.
The closer you get to the crown, the harder it is to pursue a normal, independent job. President is not very good in this respect. You know, there have been, Prince Edward did try to pursue an independent career, setting up a TV company, which ultimately went bust. There's the example of Prince Andrew, who is allegedly, you know, had dealings with bankers, and obviously that came to grief. So it's not easy to earn your own corn as a royal.
And yet there's talk of a deal with Oprah Winfrey, who is a TV producer and presenter and star in the United States. That might produce money.
Well, there's talk of a deal. That was before they announced their, you know, their stepping back, as it were. And I think that TV arrangement was to, you know, promote some of their charitable causes. Now, if that was translated into something purely commercial, then that would be a different matter. And of course, you know, I don't think the palace would be totally happy if on the one hand, Harry and Meghan were pursuing some royal duties, and on the other hand, they were just independently making money on their own.
And the security aspect, because it's very expensive. We know, don't we? I think you've given us a figure of what, £100 million is spent each year on security for the royal family. We don't quite know what proportion of that goes to Harry and Meghan. But would they have to pay for that if they pull back from royal duties?
Well, that's it. That is an interesting question. I think there is some precedent of minor royals when they're not living in royal palaces, you know, picking up the tab for some of their security. But I would have thought for someone as high profile as Harry and Meghan, for them to pay for the security would be an enormous bill. So I can't honestly see that happening. And of course, if they are, as they seem to suggest, be sort of traveling between the United Kingdom and North America all the time, that will be extremely expensive. You know, if you're having a royal protection officer, you know, holed up in a ranch in Canada, bills are going to be very expensive. So in theory, you'd hope that maybe Harry and Meghan would pay for it, but I don't really see it happening.
How do other royal families, for example, in the Netherlands, in Scandinavia, for example, how do they cope with this?
Well, it's interesting. In Europe, with most of the European royal houses, you know, they only have about half a dozen working royals. So they already got this slimmed down monarchy that Prince Charles has talked about. And it seems to work pretty well. I think Sweden is quite an interesting example where you've got about five or six working royals. And for instance, the sister of the crown princess, she regularly comes to London, has a pretty ordinary, you know, normal existence.
You mean she's got, if we can put it this way, David, without being thrown in the Tower of London, she's got a proper job.
Well, I'm not sure of, yes, in theory, I'm not sure of her actual, you know, employment work, whatever. But, you know, she just lives relatively normally. And I think the problem is that once you start being a royal and then you sort of back off and you step down, I don't think that works. I think you almost have to do it at the beginning, because there is a danger that they back down and they cash in on their royal status. And that won't go down very well. It looks as though they're, you know, having their cake and eating it.
David McClure, author of a book on royal finances. Still to come in the podcast, why starfish are being used to help the development of robotics.
They can do all sorts of locomotion and manipulation feats. They can basically take on a whole lobster and crack it open and eat it. And big, hard shells, they can do that. And they do all this with a distributed nervous system. They have no central brain.
Plus, we meet the French doctor who's still working at the age of 98. Next, we go back to 2014 and a high-profile campaign spearheaded by Hollywood star Angelina Jolie.
We must work together in new and unprecedented ways across borders and religions, bringing governments and people together and tackling the problem from every possible angle. And by doing this, we can end the use of rape and sexual violence as a weapon of war once and for all. We really can do it.
Angelina Jolie was speaking as part of a campaign with the then British Foreign Secretary William Hague to end sexual violence in conflict zones. But that campaign has now been criticised by a British watchdog for falling short and letting survivors down. Our global affairs correspondent Naomi Grimley told me more.
There was an awful lot of publicity. As he mentioned, Angelina Jolie was flown into London. She also went on a trip to Eastern DRC with the then Foreign Secretary, William Hague. And it was an issue where Britain was showing leadership, was talking a lot about what has been a very stigmatised issue of rape as a weapon of war. And the report out today does give them credit for sort of trying to flag up the issue. However, it does seem to be a very sorry saga of warm words, but actually not much behind it.
So some credit, but what went wrong?
Well, really, it's a case of funding waning and also ministerial interest waning. Let me give you an example. In the first year of this programme, Britain was spending $45 million and it had about 34 staff working on this exclusively. By 2019, that had fallen to $3 million and four members of staff. And also things like a big summit that was supposed to be held last November got derailed because of the general election. Basically, as soon as William Hague moved on from being Foreign Secretary, it seems that no one really in the Foreign Office cared so much about this pet project. And perhaps most damaging of all is a recommendation or observing that the fact that some survivors were asked to sort of relive their stories in very, traumatic ways for them, and yet they weren't given the sort of backup and support and the sense that their stories were being listened to and followed up on.
Yeah, feeling they were let down. Has the Foreign Office responded?
Yes, it has. I mean, it claims that the report doesn't fully recognise the leadership and the impact that this scheme has had, and it points out that there will be a conference later this year, the one that got cancelled because of the election. They also point out the amount of money that has been spent, but I think it does, you know, begin this debate again about whether Britain's aid budget is being spent in the right way and whether sometimes perhaps it's all about big headlines and not about substance.
Naomi Grimley. Huge demonstrations are taking place in France today as part of ongoing strike action against government plans to reform pensions and push back the retirement age. But not everybody in France wants to retire early. Christian Chenet is France's oldest GP or family doctor. At the age of 98, he still treats patients twice a week in his medical office just south of Paris. Lisa Louis went to visit him.
If it weren't for his hunched posture, you wouldn't be able to tell Christian Chenet's age. The 98-year-old is walking energetically as he's taking in his next patient on a recent Monday morning. He checks the man's blood pressure and writes down a few prescription drugs. For Chenet, to stop working is out of question.
On est trois médecins pour 19 000 habitants. In this area, there are only three GPs for 19,000 inhabitants. Given that there is such a shortage, I keep on working as a doctor. Plus, the people here are really nice. You feel useful.
On sert à quelque chose.
But he doesn't only do this for the sake of his patients.
Il n'y a pas de secret pour devenir centenaire. Il faut pas s'arrêter, non, il faut pas.
There is no secret to becoming a centenarian. It's straightforward. The worst thing you can do is to stop doing things and suddenly spend all day sitting in an armchair watching TV. It's good for my health to keep active.
Il faut garder une activité, mais une activité adaptée, quand.
Outside the surgery, dozens of patients have been waiting for hours. For them, Chenet is well worth the wait.
I'd be so sad if he stopped working. We would have to find another GP, but it wouldn't be the same. He's really special. He takes us as we are, no matter if we're black, white, or Arabic.
Donc il prend tout le monde la même chose.
This town is one of about 11,000 municipalities across France that's short of GPs. But not everybody in France agrees doctors therefore should work beyond retirement age. French unions have been striking for weeks against a planned pension reform, which would push back the country's full rate retirement age from 62 to 64. Back in his office, Chenet agrees that not everybody can go on working up until old age, and yet he does think there is scope for some leeway in France.
I think 90% of the people are not too tired to keep on working in their 60s. France is really exceptional in Europe. Only 20% of our old people work compared to between 40 and 70 in other countries. That's a pity. There are lots of sectors which don't attract young people because the pay is not very good. We should get old people to do those jobs.
C'est pas rentable. On pourrait utiliser les anciens, faire les choses qui sont pas rentables.
Chenet says he will only stop working once he gets too tired, but it doesn't look like that will happen anytime soon.
Lisa Louis reporting. Modern robots come in all shapes and sizes, but many of us still think of them as having a vaguely human form. Now, scientists are investigating whether starfish would be a battle model for future development of these kinds of machines. Dan Damon has been speaking to Eva Canso, Professor of Aerospace and Mechanical Engineering at the University of Southern California. So what is it about starfish?
They are quite remarkable organisms. They are slow, but they are extremely robust, and they can move on all sorts of terrains, from very smooth glass surfaces to very rocky and sandy terrains. They can attach to all sorts of terrains. They can withstand large flows at very high speeds and very high accelerations, up to 40 times gravity. And they can do all sorts of locomotion and manipulation feats. They can basically take on a whole lobster and crack it open and eat it. And big, hard shells, they can do that. And they do all this with a distributed nervous system. They have no central brain and a very distributed sensory motor system.
I'll come back to the brain part in a minute, but what about the musculature? What is it that you've studied that says this might affect the design of robots?
So on the musculature system level, they have two types of muscles, or two types of actuations, as I call them, coming from an engineering background. They have, if you take a sea star and you turn it on its, and you look at its ventral surface, you see that it has tube feet, those very soft membranes. They are muscular membranes. They are called tube feet. They are able to extend and contract, and they sense cues, mechanical and chemical cues. But they also have muscles along the arm itself that are connected to what's effectively like bones along the arm. So we don't study the muscles that are along the arm. We are studying specifically the tube feet that they use to move on various surfaces.
we tend to think of robots as being like mechanical humans, but you're saying that no, a robot that follows animal structures might be better.
In certain situations, absolutely, yes. If you want to send a robot underwater to do exploration and ocean exploration or to assist naval operations, you probably don't want it to look like a human. We're not known to be very robust in underwater environments.
So how far have you got with this? When will we see Starfish robot number one?
Not very far from now. It's still in the research stage. We are working with a group of soft roboticists at UC San Diego, where they are looking at developing. We have like a preliminary versions of these robots, but they are not completely, we're not very far, but it's not there yet.
Professor Eva Canso. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
The situation in Iran is at the top of the news agenda.
Qasem Soleimani was killed on the orders of President Trump.
But what is the context?
Khomeini understands us.
Khomeini is a traitor.
Last year, the BBC World Service made a podcast drama, Fall of the Shah, about the Iranian Revolution in 1979.
We don't have to be afraid now. Look at us.
To hear how it all began,
we have profoundly misunderstood this country.
Search for Fall of the Shah wherever you get your podcasts.
Join the millions of players around the world and bring in the new year with the all-time favorite classic match 3 game, Candy Crush Saga. It's fun to play and challenging to master, with thousands of levels to switch and match your way through. Get that sweet feeling this new year with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.